Is that go? Well, thank you again for the opportunity. This is the second in a continuing series of educational sessions on research ethics. You may remember the last time we talked about the history of research ethics and why it was important to look at these issues. And today we want to look at the question of what are the rules? And I know I'm preaching to the choir. A lot of you are familiar with these much more so than I am. But I thought it was important before we get into the 22 topics that I've been given as an assignment that we lay a foundation to be sure that we're all starting from the same page. So I had Linda and her staff copy some documents that are important as we look at these issues. And I'm not going to go over them in any detail because we don't have time to do that. But I want to hit some of the highlights. It's of particular interest because of the history that we looked at last time. It's of particular interest that in 1900, the Prussian Minister of Religious, Educational, and Medical Affairs set out a document giving some rules for research on human subjects, which are very much like the contemporary rules that we follow. But you remember the history was that the Nazi physicians during the Second World War did these experiments on humans for the good of the state, neglecting the good of the research subjects. And after the war, the Nuremberg trials led eventually to the Nuremberg Code, which was promulgated in 1947. And it has 10 statements, the longest and probably the most important of which is about consent. And classically, when we think of consent, there are three components to it. The person giving consent must be competent. They must be given adequate information. And they must be free of coercion. And that's set out quite clearly in paragraph number one of the Nuremberg Code. But the code also looks at avoiding unnecessary suffering and injury, protecting the subjects, research being done only by qualified researchers, and that the subject can end participation, and that the researcher must terminate the experiment if there is reasonable suspicion of the possibility of injury, disability, or death. Just a little tangent about the subject can end the participation. When I was in medical school, I volunteered for every research subject that came along because I was exceedingly poor and needed to get some money, and so I would step up to the plate. And I volunteered to be in one study where they were administering a synthetic ACTH in the butt. Smarted a lot. But had to live in the hospital for, two or three weeks, and every single meal was the same as the last one and the next one. Had to eat the same thing all the time. Had to sleep in the hospital because they did tests through the night and so on. After about a week of that, I said, this is terrible. I don't care how much they're going to pay me. This is terrible. I want out. So I went to the PI, and I said, enough. I want to leave. And he wouldn't let me leave. I mean, he was a big, huge guy, the chairman of the department. And he just intimidated the heck out of me. So I put up with it for the rest of the time. Not clearly against the rules. So the Nuremberg Code laid out this foundation. And subsequently, the World Medical Association looked at the issues as well and put forth the Declaration of Helsinki, just because it happened to be that's where the WMA was meeting in 1964. And it's been updated four or five times, most recently, at least the most recent that I'm aware of, is in 2000. And you've copied that in your handout as well. And again, I won't go over all of it, but let me hit two or three highlights. In the introduction, paragraph 5, considerations related to the well-being of the human subject should take precedence over the interests of science and society. Seems so fundamental, seems so intuitive, but it was really that issue which got the Nazi physicians off track. And then over on the next page, they even looked at issues of environment and welfare of animals and so on. And number 13, the protocol should be submitted for consideration, comment, guidance, and where appropriate, approval by a specially appointed ethical review committee. Ta-da! That's you folks. 14, protocol should always contain a statement of ethical considerations. 18, can only be conducted if the importance of the objective outweighs the inherent risks and burdens to the subject. Number 22, subject must be adequately informed of the aims, methods, sources of funding, and possible conflicts of interest. That's been an ongoing problem. When I was on the IRB here a decade ago, we used to continually wrestle with how much information does the subject need to know about who's paying for this and are there potential conflicts of interest. That's an issue that I think is very important and often not looked at carefully enough. Number 23. The physician should be particularly cautious if the subject is in a dependent relationship with the physician. And this is getting at the big divide between clinical care and research. Number 24, consent for incompetent individuals. Number 25 addresses minor children and their ability to give assent. 26, I'd just like to mention this, expand on this briefly. The research on individuals for whom it is not possible to obtain consent. Only if the physical or mental condition that prevents obtaining consent is a necessary characteristic. In other words, you can't do research on people with dementia just because they don't know what you're doing when you're really trying to study adrenal function or something else. You can do research on patients with dementia only if your research has to do with dementia. And you couldn't do that research on somebody who doesn't have dementia. And I don't know if you're familiar with the polyheme study. This was a study proposed 7 or 8 years ago, proposed and carried out, looking at the efficacy of a synthetic blood product called polyheme, manufactured by a company named Northfield. And they wanted to be able to give this blood substitute to victims of hypovolemic traumatic shock. So automobile accidents, somebody's bled out, in the protocol that you put on mass trousers and you do everything else possible. And because you don't have any blood and you don't have time to cross-match, you start giving them half of them polyheme and half of them Ringer's lactate. And you take them to the ER standard and so on. In the ER, one would think that the research would stop. But no, they wanted to continue giving the polyheme for another 12 hours, and they had biologic reasons for it. But that's against the rules because you have a standard product, natural blood, and you can't do research continuing a synthetic product when you have no basis for knowing that it's going to work. And I was at the University of Vermont at the time, and they were approached about being one of the research centers, and I looked at the protocol and I said, you can't do this. And the trauma surgeons got really upset with me for putting the kibosh on this. And then a couple months later, the whole thing blew up all over the front pages of newspapers all around the country saying, this is bad research, this is unethical. So they thanked me finally.
I do have a comment on that. One subtle, but at least to me, important point. They were not marketing it as a blood substitute because the criteria to call it a blood substitute means that it has to meet or exceed all the characteristics of blood. Right. It was an artificial oxygen.
Right. Good point. Right. I mean, I told the researchers, you know, if I were in an automobile accident and had hypovolemic shock, I'd rather have this than Ringer's lactate. But when you get blood available, no, I want to go back to that. Okay. then section C, beginning at the bottom of page 32, additional principles for medical research combined with medical care. And that's an issue that just comes up repeatedly, and I don't have to tell you folks this, but a physician caring for a cohort of patients develops a research protocol, says, hey, my patients would fit into this. And how do you take off the clinician's hat and put on the researcher's hat? How does the patient take off the patient's gown and put on a subject's gown? And you folks have to be really cautious, conscientious about looking at these issues. And probably the most significant part of the 2000 update on the Helsinki Protocol is at the very end, the issue of using placebos, trying to clarify the earlier language of it. Then let's look briefly at the Belmont report, and this is sort of the red flag or the yellow flag that you look to most commonly in trying to decide about what's acceptable and what's not. And remember, historically, this came about after the exposure of the Tuskegee study that had been going on for 30 years when men with syphilis were not given penicillin in order to follow the course of the disease. And so this large commission, which deliberated for a long time and had some interesting sideline outcomes, but the product of this is called the Belmont Report because they met in Belmont, Massachusetts, was it? At the Smithsonian. Maybe it was a building called Belmont or something, but that was named after the place, not the anything else about it. And again, they talk about the boundaries between practice and research. And then they outline three basic principles. And when we talk about clinical ethics, generally we talk about four principles, but they combine two. And number one is respect for persons, which is often described as patient autonomy and the person's right to make decisions about their own care and so on. And then number two is beneficence, and that really includes the two principles of non-maleficence, do no harm, and beneficence, while you're at it, do some good. But they put those two together. And then the third that they talk about is justice. The paragraph just before the talking about justice, they talk about research prevents more than minimal risk, for example, with children. And there was a huge debate that went on for probably two or three, maybe 4 years between Paul Ramsey, a rather conservative Presbyterian scholar at Princeton, and Richard McCormick, a Catholic from Notre Dame. And they took two positions, and in the literature they debated back and forth for a long time over whether children should not be used at all, Paul Ramsey's position, or Richard McCormick's, that that limit would rule out the possibility of some very important research, and maybe the individual infant has some obligation to society to try to improve things. Tough call, tough call. And under justice, there's a lot of meat there, and they mentioned five different approaches to justice. At the bottom of page 35, left column, to each person an equal share, to each person according to individual need, to each person according to individual effort, to each person according to societal contribution, and to each person according to merit. I mean, we tend to think that we have a pretty good idea of what justice means, but there's really some subtleties. In fact, there's a classic book written by Karen Lebeck called The Six Theories of Justice, which include these five, and then she talks about liberation theology as a sixth option. Then, under applications of these principles, how do they fit? What difference do they make? Clearly leads to the concept of informed consent. And the they talk about three different standards. Really only two are used very much in the literature. They propose a third one. One is the reasonable physician standard. What would the reasonable physician want to let the patient know about? What would the reasonable researcher want to let the subject know about? And that's an older standard and has been pretty much replaced by the reasonable patient standard, or the what would the person want to know? And they propose a third, the reasonable volunteer standard, which hasn't really caught on very much, but I think it does pay to think about that as you're thinking about who might want to volunteer for this protocol that you're looking at. The components of consent, adequate information, two, comprehension, so the person has to have capacity, and third, it needs to be voluntary. And then going on to assessment of risks and benefits. And it's here that you have the definition of minimal risk, which is quoted at just about every IRB meeting that I've ever attended. And then on page 38, The assessment of the justifiability of research should reflect at least the following considerations. And they list five things. I won't go through them individually now, but it's important to understand what the basic foundation is. And then some thoughts on the selection of subjects. And I made a copy, had to make copies of the Common Rule for you, because this is a document that has a lot of meat in it and a lot of detail, and we don't often think of it or refer to it. I'm sure that Linda and the staff there do more so than you folks do. But talks about exempt, what research is exempt. Here's the definition of minimal risk over on page 41. And then on 43, the IRB functions and operations. Got to have a quorum of the members in order to be legitimate, and then to approve something, you have to have a majority of those present. I mean, these are federal regulations. And the criteria for approval, the risks to subject must be minimized, the risks to subjects are reasonable, selection of subjects is equitable, informed consent will be sought, informed consent will be appropriately documented, adequate provision for monitoring, and the protecting the privacy of the subjects. These are all things that you look at every time you look at a protocol. and then besides the basic elements of informed consent on page 46, then it goes on to additional elements when appropriate. Sometimes the basic elements are not sufficient. And I think at subpart B on page 48, additional protections for pregnant women, human fetuses, and neonates. And on page 51, additional protections for prisoners. And you may not, just off the top, it doesn't seem like prisoners need extra attention, protection. But when you stop and think about it, and I guess this came to me so clearly when I read a book several years ago entitled Acres of Skin. It was written by a dermatology researcher in Philadelphia who walked into a prison yard. He was going to see if he could do research there in the prison. And he looked at the prisoner and he said, "Wow, look at those acres of skin." And the point of the book was that prisoners who have had some of their rights taken away from them, are easily subject to coercion or undue influence by being given extra privileges, by a promise of a shorter reduction in their sentence, and so on. And so it's easy to get them to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do on the outside. And that book documented that many prisoners suffered scarring of their skin and a few deaths because they were so easily coerced into volunteering. And then subpart D's on additional protections for children. So that's a very brief overview of what documents you can refer to, and I hope that you'll keep these in your files, and when you're reviewing a protocol that raises some issues, use these documents to help give you some guidance. Questions? Comments? Good. So this, as I said, this is probably preaching to the choir, but I think it's important that we know what foundation. And I thought next time we'd look at the issue of consent and some of the details and some of the thorny issues that can come up in relation to that. Okay? Okay. Yep. You're welcome.